Whether you're a knowledge worker or someone who leads them, you need the proper skills. Leadership, communication, teamwork, emotional intelligence, strategy, and tactics. This is the place to learn them. My name is Jose, and I'm a product manager and coach with 15 years of experience in the software industry. Visit josemoda.net to get your free coaching call or email me at podcast@josemoda.net. Back to the show. Many companies today appreciate the value of doing work in an iterative, incremental fashion. While there are some clear, valid outliers to this claim, most digital product companies and consulting groups understand the positive impact of delivering quality products early and frequently with close to direct feedback from their users. Most believe that 2 or 3 weeks is good enough of an iteration. However, a common challenge arises when coworkers, customers, stakeholders, and managers have to inspect progress almost on a daily basis. How do you show up with meaningful, inspectable progress every single day and enable decision making? To answer this question, let's consider the following key points: context, planning, and informed execution. When you understand all three, you will create yourself conditions to not only strategize for the long term, but also be able to plan each and every single day for tangible progress. Let's start with point number one, context. Understanding the circumstances around us set the right foundation for meaningful work. And to do that, I'll break this down in two sections. Number one, people, and number two, the problem space. Understanding the circumstances around people will give you a strong foundation to how you communicate, how you interact, how you give and receive feedback, and how you set your dynamics overall. When you're part of a team, you engage with other people. I've managed these types of people before: your coworkers, customers, your managers, stakeholders. Understanding who they are and what role they play sets the record straight for what it is that you have to do and also what level of expansion you should strive for. Let me give you a specific example. Let's say you're a front-end developer. What is your expansion zone? It should be the people who work on the back-end so you can communicate with them, and also the user experience designers. You should understand how they think and how they work so that you can inform your own processes, your own activities. That is the expansion zone. You're not just strict into your own silo, your own dome. Be willing to stretch outside of your own default zone. Expand yourself to understand and have empathy for those you work with. When you understand clearly what you do and what others do, you will be much better off when planning your work, when executing your work, when inspecting your work. Speaking about work, one of the most key components is the processes. I'm not a huge fan of complex processes, rather I would most likely simplify those, but ultimately there is still a process. Understanding what those are is important to, again, set the right foundation. If you ask your manager or your own organization what is the level of governance around these processes, you'll get a much better understanding of what your boundaries are and what is the level of stretch that you can commit to. Because processes should not be set in stone, rather they should be subject to change and to evolution, rather. Ask yourself a couple of questions, you and your team. What is the current process? What is the level of evolution that we as a team can give to such processes? One of the most common challenges for teams is that they feel like the process isn't their own. So they kind of lose the identity of how it is that they work and how they're more productive. That is a challenge that I face myself. And very frequently, I challenge these assumptions, these constraints of the process not being the team's. This is a great opportunity for coaching the team to not only be autonomous and be self-managing, but also to be informed about the way that the team can work and how the team should work in the context of the organization. There are aspects of the team that they could and should control, and there are aspects of the organizational level that require certain parts. Finding the right balance between the two will give you a really good head start to being productive, understanding those constraints. Now, the main reason why I'm recording this podcast is actually twofold, and I'm actually going to start with this one. It's called the curse of knowledge. It's a cognitive bias that prevents us or hinders us from sharing what we know. When we keep things in our head, we are risking someone not understanding what a problem is or what a solution is. If you're doing some work and all of your annotations, all of your insights, all of your learning is not somewhere out there for other people to appreciate, you keep it all in your head, there's a stronger chance that you will have issues around communicating, about getting feedback, about receiving it. This is surprisingly more common than I thought it would be. Everyone should have this very clear notion that what we do is not for us, it is for others. Product teams build products for others. What we do should adopt that mindset too. If we're building some sort of user interface, a web app, or if we're building some sort of backend functionality, all of the results should be shareable. They should be intelligible. I just remember Richard Feynman saying that the best way to learn something is to teach it to others like they were 5 years old. That is the fundamental evidence, or at least Feynman claims, that you're actually learning something effectively. It is so complex that your effort in trying to simplify that explanation or that learning, that really counts. So back to the main point. When you work with a team, avoid the curse of knowledge and strive to shape the way you work into a mold that is shareable, that is interactive, that invites discussion, feedback, suggestions. Now that I've approached people, let's focus on the second part for context. It's the problem space. It answers the two questions. Why are we doing this work? And what is the problem per se? These two questions are very important as they shape every decision that we make to meet that problem, to solve that problem. Digging deep into understanding the problem gives us insights on what the best solution could be. A great way to illustrate the problem space is actually one of my favorite visualization techniques ever. It's called bridges. It was invented by Railsware, and it stands for 6 main components. So bridges is an acronym. It stands for benefits, risks, issues, domain knowledge, goals, and finally, solutions. Understanding the problem space is very user-centered. Someone usually has a problem. Someone usually has pains to mitigate. Someone usually has a job to do. Someone usually has gains to achieve. Mapping these into these 6 different letters, 6 different components, grants you the visibility of the problem. And you can also match that with a preliminary solution, a high-level solution. We'll be talking about digging deep into the solution space afterwards. But understanding the value proposition is key. When you find a problem, you want to propose something that will solve the problem. If you combine bridges with the value proposition canvas, I've slid it in there on purpose, so that is identifying the jobs that the user does, the gains they want to achieve, and the pains they want to avoid, creates the ultimate set of conditions to offer a good, meaningful, purposeful, valuable solution. To sum up this topic of context, the major benefit from understanding it is you attain purpose. You know why you do the things you do. Most teams that I've worked with didn't really have a purpose, or the purpose was a little bit shallow or misinformed. The role of a product manager, for instance, or a leader of an organization is to share that vision. That's why it is so important to share such a vision. People now understand why they're doing the work they're doing, and that ultimately drives them to build the best solution at the time. Now that I've shared my thoughts on context, let's switch to key point number two, planning. Notice that I'm not talking about plans, but rather about planning, the activity of planning. Planning brings forth a solution that solves an actual problem and sets the stage for deep work. That's what it means. Whereas before I've mentioned the problem space, planning focuses on the solution space. The two are interconnected by a fundamental link. A problem exists because customers have it. The solution space aims to solve those problems. We can think of multiple solutions, and the best one is always going to be the one that solves the customer problem the most effectively and the most efficiently too. You can have a potentially very, very effective solution, but if it's not efficient enough, it won't work because you're not solving it at all. So when thinking in the solution space, there are three questions that I typically ask my teams. What are the outputs we produce? How do those outputs meet the proposed outcomes? What are the activities that produce such outputs? By asking these three questions, we are creating a link between our solution and the problem. We're being very clear about the expected product of our work, and we are breaking it down into things we do. So we're asking three questions: why, what, and how. These are the golden question forms for any problem solving. Why, what, and how. I'm just remembering, Simon Sinek has this diagram. In his book, Start With Why, it clearly proposes these three question forms. And you start with why. How do the outputs that we produce meet the proposed outcomes? How do we answer the why for the customer? Once we know the why, we can then define what do we do, what are the outputs we produce to meet that problem. Once we know the what, we can then figure out the how. And that is the activities, the scheduling, the resource allocation, any form of purchases or procurement that we need to conduct to meet that output, to produce that output. Those are the sort of things that answer the question, how do we produce such outputs? Now, a great question that comes out of what do we produce and how do we get there, sometimes the team will just say, oh, this activity needs 8 days or 4 days or 2 days to complete. I'll be honest with you, not many people want to hear such an answer. It's almost anecdotal. When someone says, this whole thing is going to take me 3 days, the immediate question that, at least for me, it pops into mind is, how can you break that down into smaller steps? Can you grind that big thing into smaller things? That's the whole point of refinement. If you think of refining the backlog, all of those activities around refining your user stories or your product backlog items, that's the whole point. Jeff Patton, in his book, User Story Mapping, talks about this very challenge. When people say that something takes X amount of days, it immediately begs the question, what smaller things or small components make up for that big activity? Can we break something down into smaller things? My immediate recommendation is to be aggressive in that breakdown, to the point of every single day showing tangible progress. That's the theme of this episode. Every day, create tangible progress. To make tangible progress, you must have a big picture scenario of what is the problem you're trying to solve, what is the output that you're suggesting to be produced, and then what kind of activities do you commit to produce that output. But if those activities are too long or too big, make an effort to break those down. In order for every single day, if someone were to ask you, what have you accomplished yesterday? You're not going to say, oh, I've just reached 33% of this big activity. What does 33% mean? Can you be concrete, be specific about what that number means? If you can translate that, then it should be an activity of its own. If you're building a web page that takes 3 days to complete, you can say, well, I'm going to start with the header section, that's a whole day, then the main body, that's another day, and then the footer or whatever. I'm just making things up. And that takes another whole day. That's much better than just saying the whole web page takes 3 days. Break those down into components, into phases, into steps, whatever. If you can do that, not only will you have measure of accountability, because you can say, if I'm going to build this in 1 day, I'm going to build this in 1 day. There's another side effect, which is even better. Everyone else will be able to have this sort of accountability on you, a healthy one, and you'll be sharing the results of your work for the upcoming day. If you say today, I'm going to build a header section, it is expected that tomorrow the header section is complete. Right? Make sense? Now, here's the situation, though. What if something is complex? When complexity comes in, if you're building complex work, there's a different kind of planning required. When work is not complex, then you just plan ahead with predictability, and you can be autonomous and you can be focused, knowing that the next day you'll have deep work done. But when complex work is the main topic, then you plan for experiments. You decide on smaller scope, but you make that count. Let's say, for example, that you plan on building an experiment that says, I'm going to measure this thing and see if it holds up. So the amount of deep work, let's say engineering work or design work, it takes a chunk of the day, but then the other chunk is actually to evaluate the results of the experiment. That's the kind of planning you do. You don't plan for full deep work. You plan for the results of the experiment. When you conduct an experiment, it requires some preparation. It requires building the experiment. It requires launching the experiment and verifying it, measuring the results of that experiment. So bottom line, non-complex work is more linear. It gives you enough room to be autonomous and focused on getting deep work done, on producing something. When you're dealing with complex work, the scope of what you plan is increased. Not only do you build something, but you prepare for it, you launch it, and you evaluate it. That takes time. It requires creativity. It requires time and space and a lot of feedback, a lot of interaction with other people. And that is volatile in and of itself. You can't possibly measure that. A good suggestion is to have some sort of realism coefficient. I use that in my teams. You don't plan for full capacity. You need to be realistic about what could happen. So you don't allocate as much time for deep work. I'm reminded of what Winston Churchill said one time. Plans are of little importance, but planning is essential. That speaks to the problem of complex work that is unpredictable. When something is unpredictable, it's more essential to plan for possibilities than it is to actually commit to a plan and sticking to the letter of the plan. Because everything can change. The market can respond differently. something all of a sudden breaks out and you have to change your plans. That is not a bad thing. It's actually a good thing. But at least you've went through the exercise of planning, of understanding your context, of figuring out a sequence of things to do with the expectation of reaching an output or an outcome. The activities of thinking and interacting and getting feedback, that is the key point about planning, not the result at the end, at least not as effusively as planning. Now for the third key point, informed execution. I've talked about planning and how that generates conditions to do deep work. Now it's about actually getting that work done. When you have a good plan, you save time by just getting the work done. You don't need to think every day about what it is that you do. You just do it. This is a hard thing to do, just so you know. It is hard to come up with a plan that is potentially going to break. If something is volatile, there's a chance that what you've planned is not going to work. One good solution is to reduce the amount of time that you predict. Having a solid strategy is very important, but at the tactical level, you can definitely consider the volatility of your strategy, or rather of the market. The strategy is going to be solid, but the tactics can adapt to the volatility of the market. If the market is too volatile, you reduce the amount of things you plan for. So if you think about sprints and Scrum, usually teams go about 2 to 3 weeks. If you reduce that to 1, you are reducing the risk of building the wrong thing, because that's what it's all about. We want to be effective at what we do and avoid building the wrong thing to begin with. So if 2 or 3 weeks is not working, consider 1-week sprints. 3-day sprints, that's a possibility, just so you know. Some people actually build things every day. So they plan for the whole day and that yields some sort of output. And that output is launched, it is evaluated, and then something happens. Now there's a threshold here, there's a balance. Make sure that your own team figures out what is the level of risk they're willing to take and how much time do you think it's required to meet some sort of output or meet some sort of outcome. The moment you set that up, you set yourself up for success, not only when planning, but when executing the work. Once you have that done, you have a clear plan of work. You know that you're going to do X amount of work this day, that amount of work tomorrow. The day after, you're also going to have something planned for. And that gives you the freedom to really spend your time efficiently and productively. Deep work can only take place with uninterrupted blocks of time. Some people require 2 hours to do something meaningful. Some people require more time. Maybe the subject of the work is more intense. It requires a great deal of context to get started, to be productive. I've known of people who take at least 4 hours to get something meaningful. It really depends on the nature of the activity. A couple of suggestions for this. Number one, avoid scattered meetings throughout the day. The best case scenario, at least to my experience, is to have an initial planning session, let's say every day, as early as you can, so that everyone stays in sync with what everyone is going to do. Then give yourself a lot of time to get that stuff done. And hopefully around mid-afternoon or a little bit later, just kind of touch base, even if it is in writing, just kind of saying, I've run into this issue, or I had this impediment, or I have this difficulty. Let's talk about this next morning. The bottom line is that everyone is aware and gives themselves time to be productive. This thing called time for context is a real thing. If you spend too much time context switching, you lose all focus, you lose all productivity. It looks rather evident that if you were to condense one single activity in a single block of time, let's say 3 to 4 hours, you would get it done much quicker than if you were to have meetings all day. You would have to take more than just the 4 hours. you would have a surplus because that's the time you require for context switching. That is not productive. And yet, a lot of companies, a lot of organizations insist on having this sort of dynamic of having meetings scattered through the day. Another suggestion is time locking, so fixating time for doing activities in your calendar. If something requires 4 hours, put that block in your calendar. That will not only inform yourself, it will hold yourself accountable, and it will let others know that you're busy during that time. Another option is to use what it's called the maker schedule. The maker schedule is a format of creating meetings or allocating meetings during the week in such a position that allows for leaders and managers to get a hold of what they must know from the teams as early as they can in the week, and then at the very end of the week as well. Every bit of time in between the beginning and the end of the week is for making stuff, not meetings. Have meetings at the earliest and at the very end so that you can plan and review. Everything else is about letting people do the work. That's called the maker schedule. I'll leave a link in the reference notes for you to consult. When you have this sort of daily planning, you reach tangible daily progress. Because if you have an activity that's going to take the entire day, you do have an expectation of what that's going to turn out to be. If you're going to build a web page, at the very end, you should have that page ready to be inspected, right? It's not enough to just do some work. That work should be subject to inspection in a transparent fashion. There's a reason why Scrum promotes the three essential pillars on which everything stands. Those are transparency, inspection, and adaptation. This is why. When you are transparent about what you do, the conditions for inspection are clear. And when you inspect things, you can make decisions on how to adapt, on how to change. Should we go this way? Should we go that way? And you can only make such decisions when there's something tangible, visible, interactive, subject to feedback. Now, notice that I said informed execution. What does inform mean here? Well, precisely that. Subject to feedback, subject to learning, to improvement, to automation. There have been some teams in the past that I've worked with, they had retrospective sessions about how to improve their processes, improving the ways that they talk to each other or communicate or showcase their work. And oftentimes they would say, we need to automate this stuff, or we need to reduce the amount of hard processes that we have so that we can be more productive. That wouldn't happen because there was not enough commitment, not only from the team, but also through the organization. The processes were so hard because the organization had set in stone for them. They didn't have a say, and therefore productivity would stay a little bit lower than expectation. When you combine openness to the processes and lightweight governance of an organization or a team, you give room to creativity, to adaptability, and to transformation, to performance. That's the one way to do it. When teams say we should do this, then commit to it. Commit to having some time dedicated to improving the ways you work. If something is to be automated, there's a reason why that automation is suggested in the first place. Let's say you performed an activity that lasted, let's say, 4 days. And you've learned that if you were to automate that, you would be reducing those 4 days into half a day repeatedly. So the return on the investment would be significantly high for the amount of effort that you would put in automating it to begin with. If the process of automating that procedure takes 2 or 3 days, and you're going to be saving that amount of time over the course of 3 weeks, that's a good move on anyone's book. And yet, many people think that it's all about just building stuff for the customer without any regards for our own processes. Improving our processes increases the return on the investment of our own activities, it improves our performance, and it increases trust from the organization to each team and each individual. So let's summarize our episode today. The bottom line is that to reach tangible daily progress, there are three key points. Understanding the circumstances around us to set the right foundation for meaningful work. Understanding who do we work with, how do we work with them. Understanding the problem we're trying to solve. Understanding our customers. How do we solve the problem? And that plays into the second point, which is planning. The solution space must be tightly associated with the problem space. When we do that, commit to grinding big things, big activities to small ones. Understand the three key questions for the solution space. What are the outputs we produce? That's the what. How do the outputs meet the proposed outcomes? That's the why. And then, what are the activities that produce those outputs? That's the how. Three key question forms for planning. Another key question that should drive the way that we plan these things out is, what is the minimum effort that can be made to solve the essence of the problem? Mostly known as the Pareto principle, for some, 80% of the results come from 20% of the effort. And finally, key point number three, informed execution. Once you understand the context, once you understand the picture for your planning, you can then commit to deep work. Improve your scheduling, improve your time management by locking in time, big chunks of time, for doing productive, meaningful, inspectable work. Not only should you focus on getting work done, the work you do should be prepared in a way that promotes collaboration through transparency, inspection, and adaptation. Thanks for tuning in today. Stay tuned on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen from. Do you have a question for me to cover? Send it over to podcast@josemoda.net and I'll answer it. Make it a great one.